Netanyahu claims that Israel is the only safe place for Jews in the world. But because of his record, because of his brutality, because of the genocide that he has been perpetrating in Gaza, Israel has become the least safe place in the world for Jews.
I'm here today with Avi Shlaim, who's one of the leading British Israeli historians in this country, but who's almost never interviewed by Britain's mainstream media, and especially not during the last 2 years of Israel's genocide in Gaza. And we're here today to discuss how the Israel lobby is trying to curb free speech on the issue in this country, his own personal journey from Zionism to anti-Zionism, and how he's involved in a Palestinian group to try and charge the British government with issuing an apology and reparations for crimes committed in Palestine under colonialism. Avi, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We at Declassified have been trying to document the British support for Israel over the last couple of years as it's inflicted this horrific situation on Palestinians in Gaza. Why do you think that British governments back Israel so strongly?
One answer is the strength of the Israel lobby in Britain. There is Conservative Friends of Israel. Over 80% of Tory MPs are members. The majority of the cabinet ministers are members. This is the most powerful foreign policy lobby in this country. And they organize trips to visit Israel by MPs, and they keep in touch with the MPs. There is the Labour Friends of Israel, and the same happens there. The Israel lobby gives financial support for the campaigns of MPs, whatever party, who are pro-Israeli. But there is another explanation as well. There are commercial interests, very major commercial interests that tie Britain to Israel. There are the arms manufacturers in Britain who sell arms to Israel. So the military-industrial complex in this country also supports close relations with Israel.
And you mentioned Labour Friends of Israel there, Avi, as being one of the prominent lobby groups in the UK. When we've asked them, Labour Friends of Israel, about those trips, they've replied to us saying that such questions fuel, quote, anti-Semitic tropes and conspiracy theories, including about Jewish power, money and influence. This is when we're asking Labour Friends of Israel about their sources of funding.
Israel and the Friends of Israel using anti-Semitism as a weapon to silence criticisms of Israel. This is an extremely dangerous phenomenon because Israel is a state. Zionism is the official ideology of that state. Anti-Semitism is the hatred of Jews because they are Jews. Anti-Zionism has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. But Israel and its friends have deliberately, I repeat, deliberately conflated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism in order to discredit critics of Israel, in order to smear them. Now, the Labour Friends of Israel are the mainstream Jewish organization within the Labour Party. It's an openly, avowedly Zionist organization. To be a member of that organization, you have to be a Zionist and to accept the official ideology of the State of Israel. But they claim to represent all British Jews, and this claim I would challenge. Keir Starmer described himself as an unconditional Zionist. And he, when he took over as leader, kept talking about pulling anti-Semitism by the root. And he conducted a witch hunt against us, against Jewish Voice for Labour, both because we supported Corbyn, both because we support Palestinian rights and because we are on the left of his party, and he carried out a purge of the left of his party.
And I've seen you say that you're not a practicing Jew, but that you have moved closer to Judaism because of its core values of altruism, peace, and truth. And I was wondering how you feel when you see how the Israeli government and its supporters use anti-Semitism as a way of countering critics of Israeli policies.
I'm both a Jew and an Israeli, and in the mid-1960s, I served loyally and proudly in the IDF, because in those days, I believed the Israeli narrative that Israel is a small, peace-loving country surrounded by nasty Arabs who wanted to throw us into the sea. So we had no choice but to stand up and fight. But the turning point for me was the June 1967 war. For me personally, it was a turning point because the army in which I had served, it was the Israel Defense Forces, now became the brutal police force of a brutal colonial power. And my disenchantment with Israel has continued ever since. But it really accelerated in the last 2 years because of the Israeli atrocities in Gaza. And so in the last 2 years, I've become more and more alienated from Israel. And I feel I have much more in common with British Jews and Jews in the diaspora, because the core values of Judaism are altruism, truth, justice, and peace. And the Netanyahu government is the antithesis of these Jewish values. The essence of Judaism is nonviolence. This is the most violent and aggressive and belligerent and openly racist government in Israel's history. And to be Jewish for me is to be on the side of the underdog. So I'm on the side of the underdog. I read somewhere that there's been a 400% increase in anti-Semitic episodes in this country. So British Jews should ask them, why has this happened? It can't be that there is suddenly a massive outburst of anti-Semitism that had lain dormant. The answer surely is to do with Israel's policies in Gaza, the Israeli destruction of Gaza, the Israeli ethnic cleansing of the West Bank. And Netanyahu claims that Israel is the only safe place for Jews in the world. But because of his record, because of his brutality, because of the genocide that he has been perpetrating in Gaza, Israel has become the least safe place in the world for Jews. And that is the great tragedy. And what they're all saying is not in our name. Israel doesn't represent them, and Israel doesn't speak for them.
I wanted to ask you about a group of Palestinians who submitted a 400-page legal petition to the Foreign Office in September, calling for an official apology and reparations from the British for British violence and repression during the British mandate over Palestine during 1917 to 1948. And you were one of the prominent figures involved in that petition. Can you say why you wanted to get involved in that?
This is a highly significant project. If I were to summarize my view of the history of the British Mandate in Palestine in one sentence, it would be that Britain stole Palestine from the Palestinians and gave it to the Zionists. So it's to raise awareness, to give publicity to Britain's role in the tragedy of Palestine.
And as I mentioned in the introduction, you're one of the leading historians in the world on the Middle East, and you're based in Oxford. But I think I'm right in saying that the only time that the BBC has interviewed you, certainly in the last 2 years since Israel began its genocide against Gaza, was an interview with Radio Ulster. No other interviews by the BBC. Why do you think that is?
I think that the BBC is guilty of much, much worse sins than not interviewing me. They are guilty of being one-sided and reporting only the Israeli narrative of this conflict and not reporting the Palestinian narrative, let alone the Hamas narrative of this conflict. The BBC has very good reporters, but the bosses are cowardly. They're afraid, they're intimidated by the Israel lobby. Whenever they have anyone criticizing Israel, they get a barrage of complaints from the Israel lobby.
And I wanted to ask you about your own personal journey, because you were previously a supporter of the two-state solution, I believe, but you've now come to support the creation of a single democratic state in Palestine with equal rights for all. What was your journey to that point?
It was a very long journey that brought me to this point. And for most of my academic career, I supported the two-state solution. That is to say, an independent Palestinian state on the West Bank and Gaza with the capital city in East Jerusalem. And when the Oslo Accord was signed in 1993, I was euphoric. I thought, this is the real deal. It's a modest step in the right direction, but it would lead to a two-state solution. But it was not to be, because Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated, the Likud came back to power, and this is in 1996, under the leadership of Benjamin Netanyahu, and Netanyahu, in his first term, proceeded to dismantle and subvert the Oslo Accords, and he says time and again that he is totally opposed to an independent Palestinian state. So I had to take this on board. I supported the two-state solution, but Israel has killed the two-state solution by expanding settlements, and Israel is expanding settlements as we speak, by annexing East Jerusalem, the capital to be of the Palestinian state, and Israel has built a security barrier on the West Bank, which effectively annexes a chunk of the West Bank to Israel. So Israel has done everything to prevent the emergence of a Palestinian state.
And given that that two-state solution is dead, or an illusion, as you've called it, why is it that British ministers, Western ministers, constantly call for the two-state solution?
It is convenient for British politicians to talk about a two-state solution because it seems reasonable, but they haven't done anything to promote a settlement, let alone a Palestinian state. When David Lammy was asked, is Israel guilty of genocide? He replied, no. Genocide is a legal concept and we have to wait for the courts to determine. He was flat wrong, because we have a definition of genocide. It's in the 1948 Convention for the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide. And incidentally, this convention was signed in order to prevent what happened to Jews under Nazi Germany from happening again. And the message of the Holocaust is never again, not just for Jews, but for anyone. So under the Genocide Convention, Britain has a duty, a legal duty, to stop all arms supplies to Israel, to stop arm purchases from Israel, to stop the sale of technology or the buying of technology from Israel. Britain has a legal duty to do that now, because the convention doesn't say you can wait for genocide to happen and then say, oh, what a pity this happened.